could overwhelm him. "Please don't let something have happened to her in the hours I was gone," he prayed. "Please don't let it be that if he hadn't gone to Broad Street, if he'd only been home on time, he could have caught her before she forgot." "Max!" he screamed, and tore across the living room to the kitchenette, then the bedroom, then the bathroom, and then farther out, down other halls, into other rooms, searching every inch of the shelter. "Max! Max! Max!" She was gone.
"Wait, let me turn it on. Okay, say it now.
Blue.
52.
Part 2. Manaz Ahmadi. Naz dreamt often about the night it all began. There was just so much joy, so much wonder. No one knew then what the shadowlessness would lead to. Even when she dreamed about it now that she'd seen what it all became, the dream still never turned into a nightmare. She didn't know what that meant. Maybe it didn't mean anything at all. Naz, her coach, and her teammates were celebrating the approval of her green card that evening. They'd just found out the paperwork had gone through, and she was officially allowed to stay in the United States forever, to keep training. It sounded silly, because tryouts weren't even for another 3 years, but somehow the green card made it all real for her. She might someday become the first Iranian to medal in archery at the Olympics. She might even have a shot at gold. They were all gathered around the couch in her apartment's living room in Boston, her coach leaning over the coffee table to uncork a bottle of wine. Two of her teammates had gotten a banner printed that read, "Congrats, Naz, Olympics, watch out," and another that said, "Bullseye," and hung them on the wall right above the case where she stored her competition bow. She'd mostly tuned out the vague blinks of color coming from the TV as they laughed, drinking and snacking on a cheese plate and a cake she had baked. But something caught her eye. A red news ticker at the top of the screen flashed. Breaking news. That's when she first heard the name, Hemu Joshi. There was an annual festival that day in India, so the local news crews were already out in the bigger cities, including Pune. They'd been on Hemu for all of 7 minutes before someone working for an international station caught sight of their live feeds. Everything exploded. Within 6 hours, it was on every channel and website in the United States, and crews from every country were touching down in Mumbai and frantically renting cars by the dozens to drive 3 hours away to the outdoor spice market in Pune. Mandai, the locals called it, in a span of time that seemed impossibly short for a transatlantic flight. Naz, her coach, and her teammates all stared transfixed at the screen, unable to look away. At the time, none of them knew that they actually should have been terrified. Instead, they were fascinated, obsessed, and Hemu obliged them. He stood gamely in the street of Mandai's largest aisle for those first 3 days, giving demonstrations for curious passerby. No matter how many times he did it, it never got old. Naz could watch him for 12 hours straight, with breaks only to microwave food and bring it back to the couch or go to the bathroom. First, he would smile and say something, to prove he was real and that it was live, not a tape being looped. Then he'd hold out his hand, or stand on one foot and dangle the other one in the air. The street children who had been haunting Hemu like little ghosts since the first moment would giggle and run circles around him. Photojournalists had a heyday with those shots. News sites were filled with vibrant images of the kids playing with him, laughing, dust swirling around them, the oranges and purples of the open-air spice stalls throbbing with such rich color that it made Naz squint. Fortune-tellers made their way in rickshaws and on bicycles from every corner of the city to look upon this new wonder. Cripples were carried to Hemu by their relatives as if he could somehow cure them. Fathers were in the street, shouting at him and waving pictures of their daughters. By the end of the first day, Hemu had 62 marriage proposals, all from extremely wealthy families. There was a picture of Hemu's mother, a sturdy old woman with hair still as ink-black as his own, trying to hold all of the photos of prospective brides being pressed upon them. She'd pulled down the shoulder sash of her sari to use it like a makeshift basket, but there were so many pictures that they overflowed, the tiny faces of so many beautiful young women escaping her arms like dragonflies, flitting away down the crowded street. The day before, Hemu had been a junior customer service representative at a call center for a U.S. cell phone company and a second-string amateur cricket player for the Maharashtra team, a glorified bench warmer. He'd batted once in the last 50 games, if that. Now he was almost godlike, something out of a fairy tale or a science fiction film. The world was captivated. Hemu Joshi was the first person to lose his shadow. When Naz and her little sister Rojan were kids in Tehran, the year before their father died, he bought them a little telescope for one of their birthdays to take up to the roof of their apartment building to try to spot constellations. The girls both went every night, but for different reasons. In truth, Naz could have cared less about it. She was already old enough to be allowed into the specialized sports section of the gymnasium after school, where the bows were kept. She helped drag the heavy metal instrument up the stairs as soon as darkness fell, because Rojan cared, because she had never seen her little sister so spellbound. Astronomy had become Rojan's version of Nuz's archery. So every night, Naz grabbed one end of the telescope and helped Rojan edge up the dark stairwell. The rest of the family used to joke that those two things never really seemed to go together, archery and astronomy. To Naz, there seemed to be a connection, though. The dark sky, the stars, the white gold of the sun, her arrow arcing through the air beneath them. She wanted to watch Rojan watch the stars forever. But when Naz won nationals at the age of 21, and the man who would become her coach called from faraway Boston, his English fast and whining and almost impossible for them to understand, and she heard his offer. Athlete visa, sponsorship, the Olympics in a few years. After Naz moved to Boston, she went back home only once. That was the last time she saw her sister. She hadn't meant to mention her first American boyfriend to her mother, or dating at all. It had just slipped out. But then in the heat of the ensuing argument, she spitefully told the old woman everything about him, and the ones after. She wasn't welcome in the house anymore after that. Her mother swore she'd never speak to Naz again. Naz swore the same. She left that night, and went to visit Rojan at her university, where she was studying. Naz's heart swelled for her. Astronomy. She'd managed to win a full scholarship. The next evening, they sneaked into Rojan's lab to see her research. By then, Rojan knew far more than Naz did about the sky, but Naz followed her as best she could. She'd remember forever the stolen looks through the telescopes she shared with her, the glow of distant planets, the streaks as comets shot by. Naz often wondered now what happened to all of them. The telescopes. It would be strange to find them again someday, if any of them were still standing in this new world, changed. Survivors would come upon them in their silent domed houses, and look through their tiny glass eyepieces, and think they were magic. Sometimes science seemed like magic. To watch Hemu Joshi live and breathe without his shadow was like watching magic. There were attempts to turn his mystery into science, of course. And actually, there was some science to it. It was an obscure astronomy fact, but Naz had learned it from her sister. It turned out that actually, in a few countries, shadows disappearing happened every single year on a specific date. It sounded impossible, but it was just physics. It had to do with the angle of the sun and the seasons, the lands between the tropics of Cancer and Capricorn, and some time in late spring to early summer, to be exact.
No matter where you live, you always think of the sun as directly above you at noon each day. But that isn't actually true,
Rajan had explained to her once when she still lived in Tehran. Naz had tried to explain it to her coach and teammates as they watched Hemu on TV. The looks on their faces had made her laugh. But it was true. The Earth was too big and too curved. Even though it looked like it, the sun was actually never exactly overhead. Except in India, on a certain day in mid-May. Or as the locals called it, Zero Shadow Day. The most insane, unbelievable thing, and it happened every year. Rojan had always wanted to visit. Zero Shadow Day had become a small festival there over the decades, celebrated on successive days as the earth tilted each dawn to position a different city directly under the sun, complete with basic astronomy lessons, parades, and kite flying. Every year, just before noon, huge crowds would flock to open squares in the markets to wait for the moment that the sun was so exactly poised above them that their shadows would disappear for a few stunning seconds. Teachers encouraged kids to place various objects in the street, flashlights, basketballs, cricket bats, to see if they could outsmart the sun. They never could. Under the rolling hum of hand drums and sitars, as the earth and sun became perfectly aligned, all the shadows in the city and beneath the people slowly would shrink to tiny little dark specks on the ground, vanish, and then come back as the earth rotated on and away. Always. A perfectly scientific explanation. There just wasn't any scientific explanation as to why after that brief window, everyone else who was outdoors on that day watched the dark shape of themselves flicker back into form from the tips of their heels, while Hemu Joshi stayed shadowless and free. No explanation, but magic. So, for 3 magical days, the entire world watched Hemu Joshi dance around untethered to the earth, captivated by the ununderstandable beauty of it. Magic. Flights and hotels were monstrously overbooked. People were sleeping in restaurants and on the streets. Television channels played his clips endlessly. Poetry was written about him. He even appeared to Nuz in her dreams. Scientists went wild, but not a single one could prove exactly what was going on. And the day after Hemu's shadow disappeared, news broke that it had also happened to a group of 80-something people in Mumbai during the celebration of their own successive Zero Shadow Day festival. The news started calling them the Angels of Mumbai. It didn't sound silly at all. And then, a day after that, the third day, it happened to a group of 15 in Ahmednagar and a group of 12 in Nashik. The reports kept coming in late into that third evening, as more and more scattered cases across the state of Maharashtra were reported, family after family, village after village. It was like watching a miracle. When she heard about the Angels of Mumbai, Naz actually thought that they were all about to transcend into some kind of higher existence. And as ridiculous as that kind of statement sounded when uttered out loud, the world was so in awe that she didn't feel self-conscious, not even a little. She was standing, wrapped in a towel in her bathroom, dripping everywhere, waving her arms around and declaring it to one of her teammates and the toilet while she brushed her teeth, and she didn't feel silly or dramatic in the slightest. That's how taken the world was with it. Then, on the fourth day, it all started to go horribly wrong. Hemu Joshi had probably been forgetting things since the first moment of Zero Shadow Day, but it wasn't apparent until the morning of that fourth day. The morning that the bad news broke, Naz got up early and turned on the TV so she could watch Hemu while she fried some eggs for breakfast. The sizzle from the skillet garbled the reporter's voiceover, but the view was familiar. Since Zero Shadow Day, Hemu had been living exactly where he was first spotted, outdoors in the center of the Mandai market, disappearing only to quickly change clothes or go to the bathroom. There had been such a desperate outcry on that first night when he tried to go home to sleep that his two brothers had given in and dragged some bedding out and down the crowded, winding streets to him. Now the three of them camped in the center of the breezy, fluttering textiles aisle. By the middle of that first night, so many people had brought them blankets and other offerings of fruit and silk that their little patch of dusty concrete looked like some kind of ridiculous Sultan's love chamber. Something was strange, though. Since Naz had turned on the TV, only Hemu's brothers had been on the screen instead of Hemu. She glanced away to give the eggs a good push with her spatula, and when she turned back, she realized they looked concerned this time, not friendly. One of them was shouting, "No cameras!" The other brother reached toward the cameraman, and the screen went dark as his hand grabbed the lens and yanked it down toward the ground. "What you just saw was our most recent footage of Vinay and Rahul Joshi, Hemu Joshi's brothers, taken just minutes ago." The screen abruptly cut back to a sharp-shouldered, severe news anchor. "Since 5 this morning, India Standard Time, Joshi's family has refused the media access to Joshi, after he was found wandering through the business district of Pune, apparently disoriented and..." Naz turned off the burner, leaving the eggs half done and still translucent in the pan, and went to get her laptop. By the time the yolks had hardened into a yellowy mess, she had pieced together what happened. When the news crews woke up and turned the cameras back on at dawn, they realized Hemu wasn't sleeping beside Vinay and Rahul anymore. They woke the brothers, and the two of them went home to see if Hemu was there, but he wasn't. A search was mounted, and that's when they found Hemu stumbling around the opposite end of the market, confused and agitated. He was shouting at the crowd that he didn't want to be followed, and he was sick of the news crews, which was understandable. But then his brothers pushed to the front of the mass, and that's when the strangest thing happened. Hemu didn't recognize them at all. Most of the news crews were still obsessed with getting a shot of Hemu, the man who had captured the attention of billions. But there was a second-rate team from some American gossip channel in Nashik, attempting to drum up interest in a group of 12 children they were trying and failing to dub the Nashik Cherubs, a terrible rip-off of the Angels of Mumbai, who turned this from a curiosity to a tragedy. Their cameraman and reporter started sending video back to their little news studio in Los Angeles, but within minutes, it was all over the international networks. The Nashik Cherubs were also starting to forget things. Orlando Jong. Ori took the note off the Remington. 4. Max can't touch the gun. The shells were in a box on the floor of their closet, like a pile of discarded body parts. He loaded the gun, then in pairs he fed the rest into the pockets of his pants until the box was empty. Then he grabbed all three of his moth-eaten sweaters and put them on one over the other and covered them with the red Elk Cliffs Resort staff windbreaker he'd found in the housekeeping office. Max's clothes were still there in neat piles, but it looked as though some were missing. A shirt or two. Maybe she had seen the stack on her way out of the shelter and still been clear-headed enough to take some. Or he hoped that's what had happened. There was no blood anywhere, nor signs of struggle, so he had to believe that she had left by herself and not as someone's hostage. All he had to do then was find her. Find her fast. Next was supplies. Matches, first aid kit, flashlight. Again, some of it seemed like it was missing. He was sure they'd collected more boxes of matches than what was in the drawer. Maybe they hadn't. Or maybe Max had forgotten the exact number they owned, and thus changed it, the way she had with the color of the knife handle. Ori stood there at the useless sink, cabinet drawer open, staring at a pair of scissors, and the blank space beside it where he could have sworn they kept a spare. It was hard to tell. Last, a photograph of Max. In the floorboards by his side of the bed, he'd carved a simple trap door. He pulled his old wallet out and gently wiped the dust off. One debit card, one credit card, $4 bills, a gym membership card, and his driver's license. Ori eased the license out of the plastic window. If the forgetting ever happened to him, this would be his tape recorder, he thought. Name, date of birth, height, weight, a tiny photograph of his face. It wouldn't tell him anything he really needed to know, like that Max was his wife, and he would step in front of a bus for her, that they had no children, that they met at a football game he almost didn't go to, and then almost left early from, that he was absurdly good at skiing, or that he was secretly terrified of bees. But it would at least tell him his name, and it also was a shield for the thing that really mattered, a wallet-sized photograph of Max. It was from the night before Paul and Emmanuel's wedding, after the shadows had disappeared in India, Brazil, and Panama, but before it had gone much further than that. That evening, the guests all had been in the hotel ballroom just downstairs from where he was standing now, eating chocolates and drinking champagne. Paul and Emmanuel had opened some of the gifts early, and one of them had been a Polaroid instant camera that produced tiny, refrigerator magnet-sized instant photos. The camera was passed around as the party got later, and when Ori got a hold of it, he took a picture of Max. She had been standing right at the open French doors that led out into the courtyard, but the light from inside was bright enough that when she turned to look at him as he said, "Excuse me, ma'am," her face was bathed in a yellow glow that made her eyes shimmer. "Blue," he said. He snapped it just as the smile had started to spread across her lips. One of the other women pulled her away to gossip about something before it was done developing, so Ori stood there in the night air just outside the doors, shaking the film lightly, peeking every few seconds to see if it had finished. By the time he found her again and she pressed another flute of Dom Perignon into his hands and whispered in his ear, breath hot, her voice light with a hint of buzz, "You are not going to believe what Emmanuel just told me about the second groomsman." She'd forgotten he'd taken a picture of her at all. Ori slid the photo back in and put his driver's license securely on top of it. Even though she was all done up, hair pulled into a messy bun and makeup on, Max still looked almost the same, and it would do for showing people he passed, if he ever passed anyone, to ask if they'd seen a woman who looked like this, assuming they could remember how to speak, or anything they'd seen at all. Back in the main room, the paper that had been taped to the inside of their door since the beginning caught his eye again. There was one rule he and Max had made, long before she'd lost her shadow, and they had made the rest of them. Rule Zero, they had started calling it after they'd written the list. He pulled it down and crumpled it into a withered ball. There was no way Max could not have seen it when she left. What did that mean? How much had she forgotten? They'd made Rule Zero when they became the only ones left at the hotel. For months there had been no electricity, no running water, then no radio. Then finally there were no other guests. They couldn't avoid the conversation about it any longer. "It's not fair," Max had said. "If it was me that went missing, you'd come after me." "No, I wouldn't," Ori replied. It didn't even sound believable to him.
"Yes, you would," Max argued. "Besides, it's different. You go out all day and I stay here most of the time. If I disappeared, it would be because I lost my shadow and forgot to stay. So of course you shouldn't follow then."
"Don't." He grimaced. It felt like tempting fate to ever mention the possibility it could happen to either of them.
I only meant, if you were the one who didn't come home, it would probably be because you were injured somewhere and needed my help.
I'll make sure to get killed then, so there's nothing to come help.
Ori,
Max said, her voice horribly small. The silence settled between them, heavy. Sorry, he finally murmured. They looked down at dinner. One plastic bag of potato chips. What he'd found the last time he'd gone out.
I just can't, Max said.
It would be one thing if one of us forgot. But if you go missing while you're out looking for food, I'm going to go to where you said you went and try to find you.
That's not the deal, Ori said.
That's as good as you're going to get, she shot back.
I'll give you that if one of us forgets, the other doesn't go after. I can't do any more than that, okay?
Okay, Ori finally said. He used paper from the abandoned guest book, wrote the rule in silence and hung it up. You never go after the other person if they forget. They didn't speak for the rest of the evening. It was the best they could do, but it wasn't enough. Over the next few weeks, Ori stopped telling Max where he went to scavenge for scraps each day, or if she refused to let him out the door without an answer, lied so blatantly she knew it was so. Eventually, she stopped asking because she knew what he was doing. Later that night, after they'd made Rule Zero, Ori used a tiny bit of the precious soap they had left. The shelter had contained boxes and boxes of surplus inventory back when it was Elk Cliffs Resort, and in the early days they'd squandered it, bathing whenever they liked, washing their hair at least once a day. It made things still feel normal. They realized too late that what had looked like an endless supply in the housekeeping closets actually wasn't. They now had 200 toothbrushes left, but no more toothpaste, 900 towels, but barely any body wash. Now they were trying to stretch what was left, bathing only every few days, and only washing the essential areas. He dipped his finger into the plastic container and tried to scrape every millimeter of excess back in. Only what was needed. He reached down, away from his face and hair, and worked the slippery cleansing film over his testicles. He pulled back the foreskin, trying to spread the soap upward, working painstakingly to scrub away the vague, inescapable musk. Max was already in bed when he toweled off after his bucket bath and slipped into the darkness of the bedroom. He crawled in next to her, naked, self-conscious. Her breathing echoed softly in the darkness. When soap was infinite before, bathing never used to mean anything. It didn't reveal things one didn't want announced so clearly. But now, with so little left, and bath water from rain that they were collecting in buckets on the roof, it somehow became shameful. There was no subtlety in a world without soap. No room to pretend what one desperately needed and what one could skip tonight. No big deal, only if you feel like it too. Ori touched her back, under the tickling puff of her hair, and his fingers brushed against a t-shirt. Max rolled over, pulling him into a lazy hug, and he felt her realize he was nude and still damp mid-embrace. Her arms paused for an instant, legs half entwined with his own, her body recalibrating with dawning understanding. Ori withered, but he dug around clumsily for the bottom hem of her shirt anyway, trailed his hands upward inside of it until he felt the silken, heavy curve of her breasts. She drew him closer and took hold of his slackening stiffness with one hand. Her fingers wrapped around firmly, and she pressed her other hand over his own on her breast through the fabric. He tried to forget. The soap, being the only ones left, Rule Zero, everything. Her hands moved, warm, pulling him toward her. He couldn't. Before sunrise, Ori was packed and ready to head out to search for Max. His head had stopped bleeding. He sat on the edge of the bed, waiting for first light, too tense to sleep. If only, Ori thought to himself. If only. If only he'd come home 3 hours earlier. If only he hadn't chased the rabbit. If only he hadn't gone to Broad Street again. If only. Max would still be here. He picked up the ball of paper with Rule Zero on it from the floor and crumpled it further, crushing it until it had compacted into something the size of a walnut. It had looked the same as all the rest of the rules when he'd written it, hanging mutely around the abandoned hotel in their relevant places. You never go after the other person if they forget. But the rule was always meant to apply only to Ori, never the other way around. This, now, this was not how Rule Zero was supposed to play out, not the way things were supposed to happen. This was not an unfortunate scouting accident. It was his fault. His fault that he didn't return home in time to stop Max from leaving because she had forgotten she was supposed to stay. Ori surveyed the shelter for the last time. The more he thought about it, the more sure he was that none of it made much sense. Max knew how dangerous it was out there, so the fact that she was gone likely meant that the forgetting had accelerated, that she was starting to bleed memories like a sieve losing sand. That much was clear. But from the early cases they'd all seen, before the TV networks and the internet went down, it was usually terrifying. Victims were panicked and sometimes violent because they couldn't figure out what was happening or where they were or even who they were, but still had a grasp on other far-flung parts of their minds. In Max's case, she'd been calm enough not to scramble through all their belongings, trying to parse back together her history from the clues. She had still shut the door when she left, and had maybe taken some food and supplies with her on her way out. It was eerie. And she had taken the tape recorder with her. Ori had searched the entire shelter and was sure of it. It was nowhere there. Manas Amadi. In the summers, Nuz's archery practice was very early, before the humidity became too unbearable. From June to August, Boston was like the inside of a clay-baking tagine. It was almost worse than Tehran. She had to get up at 4 a.m., but would still watch the news for updates on Hemu Joshi's condition while she dressed in darkness before pulling herself away to go to practice. It only got worse. By the third week, Hemu had forgotten almost everything about his life. He couldn't recognize his mother, and when asked if he had any siblings, couldn't name his brothers. He could recite his phone number, but not his address. He knew he was born and raised in Pune, but didn't seem to know that Pune was in India, or that India was a country. Then he forgot what cricket was. On the archery range, Naz tried to concentrate, but her mind wasn't there. She wondered if she should go back. India was scarily close to home. Her sister emailed and said to stay, not to give up her training, that there was nothing she could do in Iran to help anyway. Nuz hid her phone in her sports bra between shots, then would lean down so her hands were hidden and text someone, her next-door neighbor, her friends back in Tehran, anyone, it didn't matter. They were all talking about the same thing. Did you see the test where HJ could only remember 4 of the days in a week? Or, HJ just tried to list all the streets in his neighborhood. Did you watch that one? Yeah. Did you see the clip where they showed him pics of his classmates from high school and he tried to name them? They'd reply. It was constant. After a few days, Nuz started to worry she was going to get kicked off the team, but then she peeked down the line of targets and realized the other archers were all doing the exact same thing. Go to CNN livestream. They have an update. She kept waiting for good news, but there never was any. Only bad and worse, Then the angels of Mumbai began to follow Hemu's path as well, just like the Nashik cherubs, all suffering various degrees of amnesia, with no discernible pattern across age, sex, education, or geography. There was one woman from Mumbai who seemed to be decaying the slowest, while one of the teenagers from Nashik had completely forgotten all the facts of his childhood and his ability to speak Marathi, the local dialect, within 5 days of becoming shadowless. Scientists from every country took over the television channels, armed with hypotheses and ideas for experiments to explain why the shadows never came back, or why without one, a mind starts to flake away like ash on a cindered log. In India, doctors ran test after test on Hemu, trying to prove it was early-onset Alzheimer's, trauma-induced amnesia from one too many cricket balls to the head, stress from the fame, hippocampal damage due to alcoholism he didn't have. Whatever. They took a brain scan from a patient in the United States, a middle-aged man who had suffered total and permanent retrograde amnesia in a car accident just a few weeks before Hemu Joshi's own case appeared, to compare to that of Hemu. Patient R.A., he was dubbed by the media to protect his privacy. Oddly, there was nothing abnormal about Hemu's images. The news reported that the two men even met, the American amnesiac and Hemu Joshi. They flew patient R.A. from New Orleans all the way to Pune for a week, to see if talking to another person suffering a similar affliction might knock something loose. It didn't. Patient R.A. flew back home with his entourage of doctors to return to his assisted living facility. After that, videos of Hemu never appeared on air again. Nuz didn't know what that meant. Reports about the other shadowless from Mumbai and Nashik still filled every broadcast, though. The experiments grew wilder as the scientists grew more desperate. They shocked them, hypnotized them, starved them of sleep, and then tried to plant memories in their delirious states, cut into their brains. Nothing worked. It sounded silly, but Nuz knew there was no other way to say it. The Earth's rotation aside, what happened to them wasn't science. It was magic. Even so, she couldn't stop staring at the scientists poking at them on the news whenever they gave interviews. The world kept following. Everyone hoped they would all get better, that they'd remember who they were, that they'd recognize their families again. But they never did. She probably would have kept watching forever, rooting for them. But eventually she had to stop. There was just nothing left to watch. Stories about the shadowless disappeared from broadcasts, and even the skeleton crews pulled back, until there was no coverage at all. It seemed to be the end. Until 8 days later, a curly-haired kid in Brazil looked down during lunch recess and realized he didn't have a shadow anymore. And then, 2 days after that, he couldn't remember his own name. The Brazilian president was on the air about 5 hours after the news broke, announcing that he'd closed Brazil's borders to all international travel to help contain whatever this was. Brazilians abroad weren't allowed to return, and non-citizens could go only as far as their embassies. It was an international outrage, but no other country dared to actually retaliate or rescue their citizens by force. They'd have to send soldiers in for that, into the place where shadows were disappearing. The kid's family vanished. There was Policia Nause Cruzam tape up around their property on the news, and the Brazilian government released a statement that said they'd been taken into custody in order to provide them the best treatment possible. The phrase chilled Nuz. Their neighbors put themselves into self-imposed quarantine. None of them lost their shadows. Americans camped angrily out in the consular hall of the U.S. Embassy in Sao Paulo. Australians built a giant barbecue on the front lawn of their own. Naz emailed Rojan about going home again, but tickets had jumped to $15,000. Airports everywhere but Brazil were overrun with desperate travelers trying to run to, or run away from, somewhere. So instead, Naz just held her breath, hoping it was some kind of strange fluke. But it wasn't. Another case showed up on the other side of Brazil, completely unconnected, near the border with Peru. Then a week after that, it seemed like all the shadows in Panama disappeared at the same time.
I didn't leave a note, because I thought that might be worse. If you just think that I forgot you and wandered away, you could eventually forgive yourself. I hope. You'd still follow our first rule, before we had the other rules. The only rule that matters now, that you won't come after me. I know, Ori, I know. I know you made that rule to protect me. You never thought that someday I'd be the one who didn't return. But don't you see? That's why it had to be like this. Like I'd already forgotten you. So you wouldn't follow me. I did it to protect you, Ori. Not to hurt you. If you knew not only that I had left, but that I did it on purpose, while I still remember you, you wouldn't understand. You still have your shadow. You can't understand. No note I could leave could ever convince you not to look for me. Convince you that I left because I had to. I had to. To save you. So I left nothing. Just disappeared. Everything looks so different. It's hard to tell where I am. I thought I was prepared. I mean, I've seen the back of the shelter where the trap is and some of the overgrown hills nearby. But the resort was always sort of foresty anyway. All grass and trees. I haven't been outside the grounds probably since everyone else from the wedding was still here. So when I got to the bottom of the mountain and looked left and right, trying to figure out where I was, it looked so unlike Elk Cliffs Road that I never would have recognized it in a million years. I had to close my eyes and figure out what it had looked like before. How to get where I wanted to go. From memory. Which is kind of hilarious, considering. It's fucking hilarious. Sorry, bad joke. I guess I'm more nervous than I thought I'd be. Out on my own like this. It's been only a few days, but I'm actually not as hungry as I expected. You remember what the scientists said, back when it started. That once a shadowless has forgotten everything, it also forgets it's hungry or thirsty, or even that it needs to breathe. God, I hope I forget to eat or drink before I forget to breathe. I'd rather starve 100 times than suffocate to death. Can you imagine? All that pain, the fire in your lungs, the slow, darkening stillness, and all you'd have to do is just take a breath. If only you could remember that your body could do it. I'm sorry, Ori. I'm sure you don't want to hear that. I find myself thinking about stranger and stranger things. Maybe it's one of the effects. Part of me still can't believe I did it. That I actually left you. It almost seems like someone else's memory when I think back on it now. For as long as I still can. Like I'm watching someone who looks like me, but isn't. The morning of that 7th day, when you finally went to the city to search for food, you gave me one last nervous look before you shut the door behind yourself to head off. The key twisted in the lock. I waited until your footsteps had faded. If there was a window uncovered that faced the direction you were walking, I would have watched you hike through the ever-tangling weeds until you disappeared. Instead, I counted to 500. Then I went into the closet, took down the bag of sweaters from the top shelf, and filled the purse I brought for Paul and Emmanuel's wedding with the essentials. Underwear, some of our first aid kit, One flashlight. Our spare hunting knife. My tape recorder. I worked quickly on purpose. So fast I couldn't think about what I was actually doing. If I'd gone any slower, my resolve would have failed. I zipped up the inner pocket of the purse, threw it over my shoulder, marched to the door, turned the lock, stepped out, and then shut it behind me. Click. That's when I paused. The finality of it really hit me then. That as soon as I walked away from that door, I'd never be able to find it again. I'd forget it. Or the way back to it. This was really, really it. The only thing that got my feet to move was the idea that came to me at that very moment. Until that point, I'd planned to go east, to try to make it to our home in D.C., just to see it one last time before I forgot what it looked like. Before I forgot you. That's probably where you would guess I tried to make it to as well. Tried, but got lost, and then, you know. But then I thought, why? Why not do the opposite? Why not see somewhere completely new for my very last days as Max? So I went west instead.
Orlando Jong. That was his last night in the shelter, although he didn't know it at the time. Ori sitting alone on a thin mattress, gun over his knee, everything he could carry stuffed into his pockets. So very different from the first night he and Max had spent there. It was afternoon in the courtyard that day, years ago. Ori was standing on the lawn, very carefully holding a champagne flute between two fingers. They called that place Elk Cliffs Resort then. The late sun warmed the left side of everything, faces, tables, each blade of grass. Beside him, Paul was practicing his speech, cursing every time he had to look at the thin, sweat-soaked book in his hands. Fuck. Fuck, he growled. You know, for a poet, that's kind of an underwhelming opening line, Ori said. Paul glanced at him. His brow shone in the high-altitude light. I can't remember the words, he confessed sheepishly. You'd think, I mean, I wrote the goddamn thing for him. He sighed, meaning the book, all the poems in it. It was his second published collection, dedicated to Emmanuel. You'd think I could memorize the one I want to use for my vows. He's a doctor. He'll never notice, Ori said. Paul laughed. Across the grass, Max winked at him from afar, dress billowing in the breeze. The game trap was now there in the place where she was standing. You'll get it, Ori tried to reassure him. One more time. Paul put the book back in his jacket pocket and took a long, deep breath. He squinted into the light. 7 years and I'm nervous, he said. Isn't that funny? Wouldn't be worth it if you weren't, Ori grinned. That day was ancient history. Only about 4 weeks after Haemu Joshi first stepped out to the ravenous flash and whir of news cameras, and a few days after the cases in Brazil and Panama appeared, the U.S. had announced it was considering closing its borders, but aside from the cases that had begun appearing in Latin America, that was as near as the forgetting seemed. It was still a dim, vague thing, a thing that was happening there, not here. Until suddenly it was. It was almost funny when he thought back on it now. There they all were, tuxedos and dresses fluttering in the fresh mountain breeze, tables set, candles lit ahead of the warming dusk, preparing to celebrate exactly the opposite of what was about to happen. The joining of memories. The promise that they would last long after the people were all gone. Instead, they witnessed the forgetting reach the United States just before midnight. The ceremony was beautiful. Paul and Emmanuel had been together longer than Ori and Max, and their love was old news to him. He hadn't expected to cry when they read their vows, and then when he did, he couldn't believe he had ever expected not to. Ori could see only half of Max's face from where he was standing, at the front next to Paul, but he looked at her anyway as Rabbi Levinson pronounced them married, and the room erupted in cheers. She leapt to her feet and stuck her fingers in her mouth in a piercing whistle. Paul and Emmanuel were lost in a kiss, but Ori jumped at the sound and then laughed when he realized it had come from her. Ori helped herd everyone into the ballroom, where dining tables and a dance floor were set up. Someone had passed streamer poppers around the crowd, and when Paul and Emmanuel entered last, Emmanuel, red-faced with joy, Paul doing a comical prance and singing a theme song he'd made up for them both, they all pulled the strings and rained a kaleidoscope of sequins and twirling crepe paper scraps down on them. "Official co-choreographer," Max said afterward, as she and Ori savored their champagne, disbelieving his claim that he'd helped Paul invent his entrance dance. They were outside in the sloping courtyard with a handful of other guests, looking at the stars and vast darkness of the forest beneath.
"I'll believe it when I see you perform it."
"Oh, you'll see it," Ori teased. "You'll see it tonight in our room."
"I look forward to it," she said, clinking the rim of her glass against his.
He could tell that in one more drink or so, she'd be ready to go make a fool of herself on the dance floor with him. She was not a great dancer, all angles and elbows, but he loved the fact that she didn't care at all. He was ready to be a clumsy, gangly embarrassment too, to hold her hands as they spun and to try to dip her, to feel her hair stick to his sweaty cheek as he pulled her back in close, to feel her fingers clutch his shoulders for safety until it pinched when he tried to pick her up into a twirl. He leaned in to smell her perfume, but it was the back of her head facing him suddenly, not the side of her delicate neck. Someone had just pulled her into a hug. "Here he is," Ori grinned and wrapped his arms around both her and Paul, making them into a gigantic six-legged monster. One of their champagnes went everywhere, disappearing into the grass. "My best man," Paul laughed, and mussed Ori's hair as he put a protective arm around Max's shoulder. "Now you've only known him for a few years, but let me tell you something about Kid Ori," he started. But then Emmanuel was there also, holding a glass of bourbon in one hand and his phone in the other. "Husband," Paul interrupted himself, and the stern expression on Emmanuel's face, whatever had been distracting him moments before, melted away for an instant as they kissed again. "Is that a patient? Is someone in labor? During our wedding?" Paul teased as he pulled back. "No," Emmanuel smiled sheepishly. But then the solemn expression returned to line his features. Ori saw he had an internet browser open on the screen of his phone. "I went to get a drink and I heard the caterers talking. It happened to Boston." There was a moment when no one knew what he meant. It was probably the last moment that anyone ever didn't know. Now nothing ever meant anything else. "The shadows?" Ori finally asked, but it seemed impossible. The rumors had begun that said perhaps it was something contagious, the new century's black plague or Ebola, but it seemed like hysteria, still easy to dismiss. There was just no real information. No one was sending any signals out of the afflicted countries, by phone or email or post or television or radio. And besides satellite images and high-altitude military flyovers, which showed nothing but stillness, and the occasional flicker of a terrified shape wandering through streets or jungle, there was nothing else to go on.
"It happened in Boston?" Max asked.
"Not in Boston." Emmanuel shook his head. "To Boston. Almost everyone there." By midnight, word had spread throughout the wedding party. The courtyard was deserted, champagne glasses abandoned half full where they were, and everyone was crowded back into the ballroom. Some were on their cell phones, and the caterers had turned on the TV bolted to the wall in the corner of the room.
"Don't,"
Max said. She put her hand over Ori's to stop him from opening the browser on his own phone, cradled now in his palm. They'd left their apartment in D.C. late that morning, and hadn't packed a charger in the rush to make it to the wedding on time.
"Save the power just in case."
It wouldn't matter. Cellular signal would go down in another day or two, before they'd run out of battery. But they didn't know that then. Ori nodded gratefully at her good thinking, and edged the device back into his pocket. On television, helicopter footage cut between downtown Boston and one of the larger highways out of the city, beneath a reporter's voiceover. The National Guard had circled the metropolis and blocked all routes in and out, putting the entire population under indefinite quarantine. There was a mini screen in the bottom right corner running at the same time as the live feed. It was a rerun of the president's speech that had apparently aired half an hour before when the news about Boston first broke. He was in the middle of assuring the public that the nation's top scientists were working around the clock to figure out the cause of the epidemic. The world was still calling it the epidemic then, as if it was some kind of simple biological quirk, some twisted proteins or mutated virus that could be solved by the right vaccine, and advised everyone not to travel except in emergency circumstances. "Stay safe, stay inside, limit travel, and limit contact with others whenever possible," his grainy image repeated. "We are doing everything we can to find a way to neutralize the spread. I promise you, as soon as we discover a cure, we'll be sending FEMA and Red Cross agents door to door through every neighborhood to distribute it." His voice was calm, but the message was clear. Do not go to the hospital. Do not go to the grocery store. Do not leave your house. Wait. Now it was clear the forgetting was not contagious. At least it didn't seem like it was. The number of times that Ori had been curiously examined or attacked by a shadowless while out scavenging. The number of random survivors he'd tried to help in the early days, who later succumbed. And he was still here, still whole. If it had been contagious, he'd have lost his shadow years ago. He still had no idea what it actually was, and he'd given up trying to figure it out. But back then, as they all huddled, terrified in the ballroom, watching nervous soldiers try to say, then yell, then desperately mime, instructions to stop and turn back around at the confused, terrified, shadowless man approaching them, no one knew if it was or wasn't something that could be passed by breath or touch. Everything else in the world had always worked that way. At the time, there was no reason to think this was any different. They couldn't be blamed for what happened then. The president's little speech box disappeared, and the split screen suddenly dropped the view of downtown to focus on only the highway feed as the commotion started. A shadowless man had wandered away from the city and was now stumbling toward the line of soldiers, crying, but not saying any words or seeming to hear the ones being shouted at him. He looked to be in his 50s, still strong, but balding, and beginning to grow a middle-aged paunch. He wore brown corduroys, a button-down shirt, and a navy blue sweater over it, pristine in the harsh blaze of the emergency floodlights. "He looks like a university professor," Ori thought dazedly. A university professor with no shadow. The soldiers were screaming now, some waving, some holding an open hand straight out in the universal gesture to stop, to fucking stop. Stop or we have to shoot. We have to shoot to kill. The man didn't seem to recognize or remember any of it at all. The station tried to cut away, but they weren't fast enough. Several guests in the ballroom screamed as the shadowless man on screen snapped to a halt, frozen upright for one lingering instant, and then crumpled to the ground.
The news anchor materialized on screen again, looking disoriented and unprepared, stumbling through a statement that was being fed to him through his earpiece.
"We want to apologize for that graphic video clip. It was not our intention to air such an upsetting image. Unfortunately, the nature of live news sometimes..."
"Holy shit, Ori,"
Max murmured, her whole body tense.
"Do we know anyone in Boston?"